From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of a pre-recorded episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Professor Francis Beckwith, author of Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Dr. Beckwith in their conversation.
Is there an art and a science to interpreting the Constitution properly, and are there different perspectives? Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, there's different schools of thought on that. The view that I'm sure most of your listeners have heard about over the past couple of weeks is called originalism, which is a view that's associated with the late Justice Antonin Scalia and the recent nominee to the Supreme Court, Amy Coney Barrett. And it's the view that we should interpret the Constitution as it was originally understood. There's a view that's associated with some more liberal justices, which is the view that it's sometimes called the living constitution view, the term coined by the late Justice Brennan. And it's the view that the Constitution sort of has to change with the times. And what's unusual about that view, I think a problem with that view, is that it tends to buy into this understanding that history is always getting better or progressing. So to give you an example from Justice Brennan's reasoning, in a couple of cases involving the death penalty, he argued that the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, he says, well, today we recognize the death penalty as being cruel and unusual, so therefore the death penalty is unconstitutional. Now, Justice Scalia has pointed out in civil writings, the Constitution itself presupposes the death penalty. It says that the government can't take life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Well, if you can take life with due process, then clearly the death penalty is accepted. And the other problem with Brennan's view is that he's imagining that somehow we're going to become a more gentler and kinder culture as time develops. But if, let's say, we become a more barbaric culture and somebody says, well, I don't think cruel and unusual should exclude, torturing people. Because after all, we're progressing and we believe torture's good now. So Scalia's point is that we have to look at what was meant by cruel and unusual when that was passed at the end of the 18th century, because it may not be the case that Justice Brennan's future, where we become less barbaric, is in fact going to be the case. Better that we tightly tether the meaning of that amendment to what was intended at the time. If, in fact, we want to change it, we have an amendment process to do that.
You've been studying politics for many, many years. You have an encyclopedic knowledge of the Constitution. Talk for just a moment about the brilliance of our Constitution. I don't want to put it in the same class as the Bible, but the more I study the Bible, the more enamored I am with the Word of God. And I suppose someone that studies the Constitution as you have has an elevated appreciation for just how grand a document this really is.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of reasons to appreciate and sort of stand in awe of our Constitution. I mean, one is that it's the longest standing. I mean, it's remarkable. You think of other nations throughout the world, Western nations, who have had over the past more than 200 years a variety of different types of governments. Right? They've gone from monarchies to liberal democracies to, versions of that under parliamentary systems. And yet we have stayed, our Constitution has remained the same, right? I mean, we've amended it. But I think the brilliance behind it is this. Now, this is what the founders were facing when they created the Constitution. In 1776, we fought the Revolutionary War, And we had something called the Articles of Confederation, which was a kind of loose set of rules for the 13 states that were once colonies. The problem, though, was that nobody was really sure whether we were really one country or were there 13 countries. Right. And so there was just all sorts of problems concerning currency, contracts, and we created a constitutional convention where they convened a constitutional convention in which they hammered all these things out. And so there were two things that the founders were concerned about. One concern, they wanted to have something that was a united collection of political entities, which we call states, that had a kind of a certain level of independence. On the other hand, though, they wanted to have a strong enough central government that would not become tyrannical like the government that they just fought a war against, the United Kingdom. And so they were deeply influenced by thinkers like French writer Montesquieu, John Locke. They were very well versed in classical learning, thinkers like Plato and Aristotle. They were obviously formed by their Christian inheritance. Some writers, in fact, I had a student a couple of years ago who was going to write a dissertation on the influence of the Christian view of original sin on the American founders, that their sort of skepticism of political power was not just the result of their experience, it was also the result of their theological beliefs about human fallibility and frailty and original sin. So all these factors are in play, and so they come up with a constitution that has three-pronged federal government that allows states to have their own governments, but not everyone's totally satisfied with this. There were people at the American founding called the Anti-Federalists, and the Anti-Federalists, they weren't satisfied with the Articles of Confederation either, but they were really skeptical of having a strong federal government because they thought, are we going to go through the same thing again here that we went through with Britain? So that's how we get the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is essentially a compromise between the Federalists, people like James Madison and others, and the Anti-Federalists. And so the Bill of Rights were put in as a limitation on federal power. So, for example, in terms of what the states can do. So this is why we have strong prohibitions against things like self-incrimination, limits on freedom of speech, very strong language about religious liberty and religious disestablishment. In fact, in the First Amendment, where it says that Congress shall not establish a religion, that's a limitation on Congress. Six of the original 13 colonies actually did have established churches. And so what the original understanding of the First Amendment was that there could be no federal church and that the federal government could not interfere with states that wanted to have established churches if they wanted to. Now, the last state gets rid of its established church in 1832, and then eventually in the 20th century, the Supreme Court starts applying the First Amendment to the states. And that's a whole other story for about the history of the Constitution. But getting back to your initial question, Hank, the brilliance of it, I think, is the result of a real, practical, real-world understanding of human nature and also a deep conversance in kind of political philosophy, both ancient and modern, that the founders were deeply aware of. These were very well-educated people. They were classically trained. They knew not only the Bible, they also knew the ancient Greek philosophers. They were well-versed in modern philosophy, medieval philosophy. They also knew about what had happened in other parts of the world, right? They were on the verge of starting something that the world had never seen before. And so there's a bit of courage there too, right? I mean, for us, we kind of take this for granted. Oh, liberal democracy or constitutional republic, that's old hat, but it was new and had never been tried before. And so I think the brilliance of it is the result of just, you know, perfect timing, with just the right collection of individuals.
And the providence of God. Talk about the benefits of a liberal democracy. You laid them out so well in your book. We sometimes take for granted the incredible privilege that we have. We can participate by voting. We have the liberty to worship. We can hold the government accountable, and many other things that you lay out in the book. And I think that has to be emphasized in this podcast, because if we don't have a high value placed on those benefits, we may well lose those benefits because we're not underscoring them, not only individually, but for our families and within our churches.
That's right. So there's so many benefits. You've already alluded to some of them. Think about how we take for granted the very fact that we're having this conversation.
Don't go away. We'll be right back and rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. Francis Beckwith. What role should Christian citizens take in a liberal democracy? What is the proper separation of church and state? What place should be made for natural rights and the moral law in the governance of a nation? How a nation answers these questions profoundly impacts whether the government under which its citizens live is just or unjust. In our increasingly post-Christian world, followers of Christ must not relinquish politics to the unbelieving world. Read Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft by Dr. Francis Beckwith. To receive your copy of Politics for Christians, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit us at equip.org.
According to Politics for Christians by Francis Beckwith, a candidate who embraces Christian ideals, even if he or she is not a Christian, is a candidate that a Christian can support with a clear conscience. Christians in America have the historically unique power to enact laws that advance the common good and must take this special obligation seriously by using good judgment while voting and supporting legislation and political candidates. This is not to say that Christians will always agree on what policies and candidates represent the best option to advance the common good, but there is no doubt that Christians have a biblical mandate to advance it. To receive your copy of Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI. Or visit us at equip.org.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.
Dr. Eben Alexander's wildly popular near-death experience book, Proof of Heaven, assures us that no matter what we do in this life, only unconditional love and joy await us in the world to come. But our Lord warned that while the gate to hell is wide, the road to it broad, and those who enter through it are many, the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Your generous support lets Hank Hanegraaff and CRI speak out against the lies that lead to hell. In appreciation for your gift today, we'll rush you Hank's book, Afterlife, What You Need to Know About Heaven, the Hereafter, and Near-Death Experiences, filled with answers to your questions about life after death. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now. Again, that's equip.org. Let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and Dr. Francis Beckwith as they continue their conversation.
Think about how we take for granted the very fact that we're having this conversation, right? And we're having this conversation, it's going to be broadcast to hundreds of thousands of people, and we will say things that people may disagree about. We could, if we wanted to, discuss actual public policies and be critical of people in elected office if we wanted to be. These are all part of our fundamental rights. We have the right to own property. We have a right to privacy. The government can't break into our house or take our papers without having a warrant, and it needs to go to a judge first. If we're taken to court in a criminal trial, the burden is on the state. And if we're going to be convicted in front of a jury of our peers, we have a right to counsel. And these are all things that are part of the infrastructure of our legal and political worlds that is unusual, at least in terms of human history. And what you mentioned about the possibility of losing it, and I kind of have that fear, Hank. I see many young people today who think of things like freedom of speech and freedom of religion as kind of interfering with what they think are the goals of social justice, or people that are frustrated or impatient with our criminal justice system. And I don't want to blame it entirely on them. I think they just haven't been enculturated in terms of their education as to why these things are good. We've seen several cases over the past 6 months concerning accusations of police brutality. And I'm not going to comment on any individual cases. I don't know enough about the facts of those cases. But in the past, when I was growing up, if we read about cases like that, I remember my father would tell me, well, you know, you're just reading what's in the newspaper. You're not in court. You don't know what the jury's going to hear. You don't know the evidence in the case. Don't jump to conclusions. That's the way people kind of handled these sorts of controversies. Not everybody, to be sure, but people had an understanding that we had a system, and the system may be slow, the system may get things wrong, but the alternative to that is far worse. That is, to allow the mob to decide based on emotion and sentiment and enthusiasm who deserves punishment and who doesn't. The processes that are in place are meant, at the end of the day, to protect us from tyranny, even if that means that sometimes injustice wins. And I think that younger people today, some, not all to be sure, don't fully appreciate that because they see on social media, which is something that I thank God didn't exist when I was growing up. They see things and they say, oh my gosh, this is horrible. Something's got to be done. It's not moving fast enough. Therefore, there's an injustice. Let's burn things down. That is precisely what will lead to tyranny, because what will happen is that somebody will swoop in, an elected official, a politician. I will do what's right. I will end all the bad stuff, and in exchange for your freedom. And people, unfortunately, we've seen this in other nations, have done that. I think it was the late Francis Schaeffer in his book, A Christian Manifesto, who said that the great temptation will be to exchange our freedoms for peace and prosperity.
You know, with the coronavirus, you've seen how quickly people are willing to give up their freedoms, even churches.
Yeah, it's stunning. And I, you know, I'm a person that when this was first happening, kind of wanted to take a step back. I'm not an epidemiologist. I don't know enough about the science. But I do know that in any sort of public policy judgment, there's going to be a trade-off. So it can't be that we must do everything we can to eliminate a virus, because if you did that, you would ultimately, you may actually result in more human misery, right? The sort of misery that results from mass unemployment, depression, which results in things like alcohol and substance abuse and so forth. So, yeah, I was stunned at how quickly, and I can understand, because I was somebody initially who, you know, obviously I still think that, you know, we have an obligation to our neighbors to act in ways that don't harm them. But on the other hand, in the cases of churches, if in fact the government is treating churches or burdening churches in a way that it would not dream of burdening casinos and bars, which is what happened in my home state of Nevada, that I think should be a wake-up call to Christians that the government doesn't think your faith is that important. They think that strip joints and bars and casinos are more important. And so when you hear politicians saying, well, we just want to keep open essential services, but churches must close, I mean, the judgment there is that church is not essential. And that, I think, is, you know, not consistent with our tradition of religious liberty.
Yeah, well said. You've mentioned the rule of law. And one of the points, and I think this may be in your book, I can't remember whether it is or not, but the second president of the United States, John Adams, of course, he famously said that our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people, and that it's wholly inadequate to the government of any other. In other words, it's not possible to rightly govern under our Constitution a world without God. What do you say about that?
I think Adams is right in this regard, that there's more to law and political institutions than the rules that are written down. That is, people have to be enculturated into believing that these things are good. And of course, and this is the element I think that Adams is driving at, that these principles are ultimately derived from something transcendent. That is, when we say, for example, that we have human rights, or that we believe that the role of the government is to advance the common good, that leads to another question. Well, what constitutes the common good? Well, you could obviously appeal to these sort of fundamental rights, but is it the government itself that creates those rights, or is it simply the government recognizing that there are these fundamental rights, that they sort of exist apart from government, and that they are connected to the sorts of beings that we are? That is to say, how are we designed? What is our end? Now, if you go back to medieval philosophy, and my favorite philosopher, Thomas Aquinas, he defines the common good ultimately as our seeing God as he truly is, you know, what he calls the beatific vision. And so for Aquinas, all our institutions, although they are there to protect and secure these, you know, finite temporal goods, ultimately those temporal goods point towards something beyond themselves, right? So I'll give you an example of what I mean by this. I began about 2 years ago when teaching at Baylor, asking my students why they're in college. And you'll know in a moment why I do this, because there's been, over the past maybe 4 or 5 years, a real kind of a diminishing of the humanities in the academic world. There are fewer philosophy courses, fewer courses in literature, and the emphasis now is more on what are called the STEM areas, science, technology, engineering, and medicine. And all those are obviously very good. So I ask my students, why are you in college? And they all say, to get a good job. Why do you want a good job? Well, I want to make money. Why do you want to make money? Well, because I want to have a family. I want to be able to take care of my children, maybe give to right causes. Well, why do you want to do those things? And there's usually awkward silence, and one or two students will say, because they're good. But why be good? And is there something beyond those goods? And my point is to tell them that all these goods in life are all instrumental goods that we engage in for the sake of this one good, right? And then I tell them, that's why you're in philosophy. That's what we're, so in a way, what we're doing here is the most important thing. That is, we are talking about the ultimate reasons why you do all these other things, right? So getting back to Adams, I think Adams is saying something that, look, a constitution or any set of laws or fundamental documents in a nation should be worth more than the paper it's written on. But if you have a society that consists of citizens who are not inculcated and enculturated with these principles as true, it doesn't matter. You know, think about something like freedom of speech. You and I grew up during a time where, you know, it wasn't unusual to hear people say things like, I don't agree with what that fellow's saying over there, but I will defend his right to say it. That kind of thinking is vanishing. And you'll hear things like, I don't like what that person says. It makes me feel bad. I think the government or the social media company should silence him.
We'll have to stop there for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Francis Beckwith. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand the life-changing outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, Hank would like to send you Dr. Beckwith's book, Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write to CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The preceding program was pre-recorded. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more.
According to Politics for Christians by Francis Beckwith, a candidate who embraces Christian ideals, even if he or she is not a Christian, is a candidate that a Christian can support with a clear conscience. Christians in America have the historically unique power to enact laws that advance the common good and must take this special obligation seriously by using good judgment while voting and supporting legislation and political candidates. This is not to say that Christians will always agree on what policies and candidates represent the best option to advance the common good, but there is no doubt that Christians have a biblical mandate to advance it. To receive your copy of Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org.